before the death of C.S. Lewis, and it's kind of fun. In the introduction to it, they speak about how the kind of repartee they enjoyed as a group, and one of the cracks I remember at this moment was after C.S. Lewis had written The Problem of Pain, and Charles Williams was teasing him, he said he had no particular liking for books that try to explain this whole problem of suffering and pain. He said he felt that really the issue was quite simple. It was all whether you were under the illusion that Earth was a resort where you could make some demands, or whether it was a reform school, or you were being taught some things for eternity. But it's sort of typical of the man. He had a hand tremor, which let me identify with him, of course, and was an editor in a book concern, and then worked with the Secret Service of England during the war. This group met once, sometimes twice a week. They'd read parts of their books. For years, this Fellowship of the Ring, which came out just 4 years ago, was in manuscript form. And they tossed it around, and they all knew of it. And he quotes from Fellowship of the Ring, incidentally, in this trilogy, even. As he says, an unpublished manuscript of J.R.R. Tolkien. It's one of the most gracious things, I think, in the history of letters. This particular group, their delight in each other, their joy of stimulating and encouraging one another, and offering the kind of encouragement and criticism that only good friends could. And you sense something of this delight in one another and the joy of a circle of friends that undergirds all of these books. You see here a real capacity for affection and friendship that continually has little glints of humor and delight throughout the entire series.
Now this is the Inkling.
The Inkling. Now, Leo really knows much more about this than I do, frankly, because he's read in this whole area, I think, everything. I've been rereading some of the things I've read before. I still haven't read but one of the children's books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I hope some of the rest of you have read some of the others. So that is a sheer delight. But there's a whole series, the Narnia series. One of the men in our faculty here took it this summer. I didn't have time to get with any of it, but the kids were simply enthralled with it. And he had to have extra sessions at night with them. And they'd read until 10 or so, and then he'd close off, and they'd hardly wait till the next day to get back to them again. And these were the youngsters from 12 to 15 or so, which, you know, that isn't exactly the fairy story age, but these aren't exactly fairy stories either. They have a real probing and effect that stays with you. But I can remember even when we read it when Andrew was 2, he's my 12-year-old now, and right away, as you got into the story of the lion, I can still remember that 2-year-old saying, "That's Jesus, isn't it?" You know, and then of course the lion is the symbol for Jesus, isn't it? So when a 2-year-old can see this, you won't have too much trouble following some of that, but yet they are astute. And as he calls that hideous strength of fairy tale for adults, I haven't finished reading it for the third time, and I'm as fascinated by it now as I was before, and I cannot skip. I mean, he's a man I find it just impossible to skip, because the conversations are, of course, a great deal of the delight. I was just noticing one of them now, just where I am at. But it's when this Englishman, Marr, is starting to come to his senses. He's been under the control of Uncle. No, not Uncle, but Smurf. Smurf is what it's called in the TV series. They call it Knights, for those of you who are new. And it's a wonderful name for this organization that's plotting to take over the earth. It's in the control of Satan and the dark power, and it's trying to manipulate man with its modern science, psychology, sociology, and so on. And the point of this whole group, of course, is beyond good or evil. These are simply terms that are man's subjectivity. They don't really exist. He says Waddington, that's the physicist, has given the best answer to all that. Frost says, existence is its own justification. And you'll find again and again Huxley is quoted, or one of the modern scientists, or evolutionary thinkers, and that these are on the side then of the dark powers. And for this, of course, C.S. Lewis got quite a drubbing, and still does. This is still a controversial book in the English-speaking world, and it did put science on the defensive. C.P. Snow, who some of you may know, is still one of those answering some of this, and The Two Worlds by him is one of his answers to these questions that C.S. Lewis has put to this, to the English-speaking world. But it's very definitely contemporary. In fact, I think some of our working group was here last night, had a tough time sleeping as they, for the first time perhaps, really were encountered with the reality of demonic powers, that these are operative. You know, we try to dismiss them by giving them kind of silly images, like a little guy with a tail and a spear, and then we can laugh about it, of course. One of the French thinkers has put, well, Denis de Rougemont's book on The Devil's Share, which is a very clever book and very well done, has a, as its theme, one of Baudelaire's comments that the devil never has no more power than when he's convinced many does not exist. And it's incidentally a good book on this. That book, incidentally, in the particular volume which I received as a gift when I came out of prison camp from Howard Hall, and in that particular edition, you were reading along and says, do you really want to know where to find the devil? You will find him, and you open up the other page in the chair where you're now reading this book. It kind of makes you jump about an inch. Well, Mary's going to carry some of the conversation here this afternoon, and others of you can join in. I have read with delight all of Charles Williams' novels, and Charles Williams being the kind of spark for this circle, I thought we should begin with him. He's not the first or the oldest of the influences in it by any means. MacDonald, George MacDonald, is one of the very profound influences upon it. There are other contemporary thinkers that have a great deal of influence in their thinking. A man like Edwin Bevin, for example, he's not the labor minister, it's spelled a little differently, B-E-V-A-N instead of I-N, but one of the excellent Greek scholars of our time. The two most famous in our English-speaking world. And he happens to be also a Greek scholar who writes in the Christian area. His book on Christianity in the Home University series is one of the most delightful church histories you'll ever read, and you can read it in an evening. Fascinating one. This is the one in which he makes a rather profound remark that perhaps only in America could it happen that people could leave the Christian church without even realizing they had left it, because our thinking has become that sloppy and sentimental. And here he refers to the Christian Scientist specifically in his book on Christianity. H.H. Farmer, another one of the thinkers that is related in the theological world to these men, but I know he, in criticizing one of the books written by the man who headed the Divinity School at the University of Chicago for some while, Wyman, said of one of his particular books that only in America could this be considered theology, and that perhaps only at the University of Chicago. That's when I was doing my graduate work there, and which when I was calling it a California sect that had been transferred to a university campus, and it was pure, simply sectarian and outside the Christian tradition, and something to which at that moment the effort at the University of Chicago was to make all of its graduate students conform to it, so two of us never did get our graduate degrees at that time, Joe Sittler and myself, because we were in systematics, and this was the pervading mood, one which simply disavowed the historical aspect of Christianity and subjectivity, and thought you could make it into a naturalistic method. But this whole group countered this kind of a spirit in our world, which became, for a while then, actually in America, centered at the University of Chicago. It may interest you to know that Paul Hain, one of our delightful men on the faculty, who has his doctorate from there, feels that he discovered justification by faith through one of the faculty members who's since come. He was my roommate, who was getting his degree at the same time and had transferred finally from Wyman over to Tillich. He headed the religion department at Denison University and come back because he said he was bankrupt, he had nothing to give his students, and discovered I was right, that Wyman was way off. And now he'd gone for Tillich. And I said, just like you will say sometimes to somebody dear to me, we've been in arguments in class after class, and we've taken up almost a whole hour fighting each other. And I simply said, well, what you need to do, Al, is to go on your knees just like some eighth grade, some layman who's never finished more than eighth grade, and read the Bible and ask for the Holy Spirit. And he did it. That was a delightful thing, he did it. And of course discovered, just as we all do when we do this, what justification by faith means. I came back about 3 weeks later, but I had a lot of trouble in the parish right then. Some funerals, and wasn't able to keep on with my studies. And I had this room I'd keep down there, so once in a while when I stayed overnight, I could sleep there. And Al looked sick, you know. I said, "What's the matter? Are you sick?" He says, "No, I'm just doing what you told me." And C.S. Lewis, you'll see, when that happens, what happens. In fact, that's just what's happened to this man at this moment. As he's trying to come to his senses. As he answers this question, then, about if existence is his own justification, there's nothing else than just that which is to hand. "Do you think, then," said Mark, "that there would be no sense in asking whether the general tendency of the universe might be in the direction we should call bad?" The names that he gives these people are significant. Mark, you will remember, was the wishy-washy one in the New Testament, too. But Paul would have nothing to do with him. He's the wishy-washy one here. Frost fits the man now that he's talking to. "There could be no sense at all," said Frost. "The judgment you are trying to make turns out on an inspection to be simply an expression of emotion. Huxley himself could only express it by using emotive terms such as gladiatorial or ruthless. I am referring to the famous Romaine's lecture. When the so-called struggle for existence is seen simply as an actuarial theorem, we have, in Waddington's words, a concept as unemotional as a definitive integral, and the emotion disappears. With it disappears that preposterous idea of an internal standard of value which the emotion produced." He's speaking here to a whole group of men who produced a great body of literature, which is all anti-Christian. I suppose its most significant member who's still alive would be Bertrand Russell. But this whole group of men in English society, one of them, who was the most famous and its publicist, Joad, and you'll discover in one of the delightful detective stories that they speak of Joadian laughter in it. It's written about it's a detective story about a Catholic priest who is a detective. And he made mockery of Christianity. Then Joad gets picked up, of all things, on a train for trying to fake a ticket for a free ride. And this is one of the outstanding thinkers in the opposition in England. But this, for him, becomes a shock, too, and he's converted. And the year before he died, he was invited to lecture at St. Olaf. Did he get there? He died before he came. But became, just as C.S. Lewis was a convert from this particular background, one of the very significant proclaimers of Christ in the last year of his life. But this idea that there's nothing in the world that has objective good or beauty or value, that it's just all in yourself. And for instance, he takes Aristotle through. How could he even think for our time in his Iron Age agricultural community? This is the way he kind of sneers at him. Anything that is older than the contemporary has no real value for it. Howard Hong on our faculty is the one who most deftly attacks this whole attitude. He calls it the cult of modernity, and he goes after it with tooth and Hammer and Tong when he's here.
Hammer and Hong,
yeah.
I just made that up.
Yeah, very good. "When you have attained real objectivity, you will recognize not some motives, but all motives are merely animal subjective epiphenomena. You will then have no motives, and you will find that you do not need them. Their place will be supplied by something else, which you will presently understand better than you do now. So far from being impoverished, your action will become more and more efficient." And this efficient idea, and what is efficient, of course, becomes demonic, becomes statistical. And the idea of the prince of demons being behind this, the one to whom you give yourself, when you let yourself in for this kind of relativity in your thinking, is a real issue all through this literature. And now he realizes, he says, this was not by no means unfamiliar to him, this philosophy. He realizes it as a logical conclusion of thoughts which he had hitherto always accepted, and which at this moment he found himself irrevocably rejecting. The knowledge that his own assumptions led to Frost's position, combined with what he saw in Frost's face and what he experienced in this very cell, effected a complete conversion. All the philosophers and evangelists in the world might not have done the job so neatly. This complete revulsion against himself and all that this relativism stood for. "And that," continued Frost, "is why a systematic training in objectivity must be given to you. Its purpose is to eliminate from your mind one by one the things you've hitherto regarded as grounds for action. It's like killing a nerve. That whole system of instinctive preferences, whatever ethical, aesthetic, or logical disguise they wear, is to be simply destroyed." Now they take him into this destruction then of any kind of values, and they use art to do it, perverse art. And the kind of art which appeals them to this kind of jungle underworld that is man, and tries to make that jungle underworld then control his action and thought. So we live sort of on the edge always of the normal. Now, out of this, he does not fall for this because of this conversion now. It's producing its opposite effect. And for the first time, something he vaguely called normal apparently existed. He never thought of it before. But there it was, solid, massive, with a shape of its own, almost like something you could touch or eat or fall in love with. It was all mixed up with Jane and fried eggs and soap and sunlight and the rooks cawing of Keir Hardie and the thought that somewhere outside daylight was going on at that moment. For us all, when we've been in this kind of a demonic kind of temptation, just a child's cry, the sound of birds, we all know what it's meant. Once more, reality's clutching at us to bring us out of this underworld that is man, that our doubt and torment bring, what Luther called despair and other shameful sin and vice. And it's this despair and other shameful sin and vice, this hideous thing that Christ is attacking in this particular novel through this little group, this little band, this remnant that is gathered in order to confront it. He was choosing a side, the normal, and that, as he called it, was what he chose. If the scientific point of view led away from all that, then be damned to the scientific point of view. The vehemence of a choice almost took his breath away. He had not had such a sensation before. For the moment, he hardly cared if frost and wither killed him. But this discovery then of the normal, a touch of the earthy, and that which is good in it, is what takes up the rest of this novel instead. But these men are all of them being motivated out of an original insight into the nature of reality as a happy exchange, as a revelation from God of one who has become what we are that we might become like he is, one who has made sin for us that we might have his righteousness before God. And this central affirmation is common to this whole group. Dorothy Sayers, who said made a good deal of money, was a wealthy woman out of her detective stories, who said finally that when the theologians had managed to make Christianity sound so dull, it was time a woman started to write and make it exciting again, because orthodoxy couldn't be anything else but exciting. J.R. Tolkien, with this vast, huge panorama of an adult fairy tale where he creates a whole new world for you, in which once more these objective values capture you and take you, which has made it the most popular novel on our campuses in these last 4 years, The Fellowship of the Ring and these hobbits, and that which motivates all of Charles Williams' novels, which are all based at this core of the happy exchange. And I thought I'd let Mary talk a little bit here. She just finished one, Shadows of Ecstasy. But this is which we all become a ransom. And ransom is the central figure of these three scientific novels. And his name has significance. Even his first name is in the second novel comes out. But his name is Ransom. And he is a reflection of that ransom which God has made of this race, so that it no longer lives under the lie, under this continual attempt of man to pervert language so that it can gain his own base end, but which forces man to be what God has made him to be, a son of God, to live in the light and walk in the light, whatever be its kind of anguishes, but which also has its rewards, where he savors the good taste of the earth and knows it as one of God's creatures for him. This kind of healing power of these novels over man's imagination is such that through them a whole new kind of literature has been developing and flourishing, and other men who are only on the outside of the circle have themselves been enriching our whole insight. T.S. Eliot, who recently died, W.H. Auden, who is still writing, and a number of lesser lights. R.A. Bradbury in the scientific fiction world in our own land has some of the same qualities, you know, who've been reading him, and with a great gift of language. But this idea of that man is actually in a state of siege, that he's under attack from these demonic powers of darkness that would try to twist and pervert him so his life becomes a lie. And one of the awful things in these books for anyone who is in any sense a scholar and has a sense of it is the way in which these men can finally even pervert truth and use propaganda instead of communication in order to thwart the insights of their own integrity as scientists. So what they've discovered as scientists becomes a means of debasing man rather than of enabling him to find that shape and destiny which is his under God. And this is part of this deep commitment of this whole group, to reassert what man is in the light of God's revelation in Christ. And that only at that point you see what man is. One of their heroes, incidentally, is Karl Barth. And they have a figure in the English world before Barth who has some of the same feeling that Barth did, a man by the name of Forsyth, who writes very exciting theology at a time when theology was quite dull. But they see this insight that it's only from God that man can take himself and find himself. And it's in this from God that is revelation that man gets his bearings on himself and his universe. Dorothy Sayers has a wonderful essay, I've only read it in German, and to which it was translated, just on what it means for drama and what it's meant for the dramatic world and the world of drama, the incarnation, and that God became man and dwelt among us. As she says, beside this all other drama pales. This is the dramatic event of our human race. Barth gave only one series of lectures in England, and they were under a series that are the most famous in the English-speaking world. Incidentally, our Jerry Pelican, who is a Lutheran, will be the first Native American Lutheran ever to give this series. He'll be giving it next year, and I presume he's going to take the Fathers. But the foundation of this Gifford Lectures is typical of the enemy that they're fighting, in that the articles of the foundation of this wealthy man who left this money to the University of Edinburgh, I believe it is, for this series of lectures, every 4 or 5 years or so one is given. You have to prove the existence of God without resort to Scripture. This is the actual will under which the money was given. And we've had, William James gave it back in 1900, and this famous book of his on, what is it called now? Religion?
Psychology of Religion.
Well, varieties of religious experience. This was given under that. And then we've had several others Americans give it, most of them Americans by adoption. But Niebuhr has given it in The Nature and Destiny of Man, just prior to World War II, in which the first book is vastly superior to the second. As is usual in that type of theology, the analysis gets to be better than the synthetic. We can analyze man much better than we can shape the paint a shining vision when we try to move in out of revelation. But they asked Barth to do it. And Barth immediately, of course, turned it back with a guffaw. He says, you men lost your senses. Everything in my whole life is opposed to what you've got to say. Well, they came back and asked him a second time. And then he says, he thought only, he says, boy, you fellows are really in a tough spot. You need me. You can't exist without me. He says, as a mission to Jesus Christ, I've got to come, and I realize that you're right, because you fellows are parasites, and you can only exist by having revelation once more declared to you. So what he did was to take the Scottish Confession, the Confession of the Church of Scotland, and gave the most hilarious lectures in the history of scholarship. They're funny. They're really riotous. I mean, it is one vast kind of a guffaw from the Christian faith over against this whole attempt of man to try to reach God by his own bootstraps of his reason. And he has a great time with it. But when he comes to the last lecture, the last particular thesis in the Scottish Confession is a prayer for God to confound all his enemies and overturn all those who are opposed to the truth and so on. And Barth, having read this and started, he looks and he says, well, you fellows feel you've got me here. I've been pretty tough on you. And he says, fine, you feel you've got a superiority to me. And he says, and you're right, he says. You do. Your position does not require prayer, if that's a superiority. That's how he begins to find the lecture. Of course, this is what made Barth so beloved to all of us and so much fun, because he is a crazy guy. And he, on the continent, represents the theological world, something that's kind of a guffaw that's in the midst of all this literature, over against this kind of pompous pretensions of man to play and toy with God's universe, as though somehow it were put into man's hands without no relationship to his creator. And his lecture, for instance, the Goethe Society asked him to give the 150th anniversary lecture of Goethe in Germany. It's a tremendous honor, and Goethe is the patron saint of this whole group of sort of anti-Christian humanists, and they asked this great theologian to give it. And he gets through, and which he's just been taking Goethe through, you know, one after another in this great lecture. Finally, when he gets the last paragraph, he says, okay, you fellows think I've been hard on the dead, we should speak well of them. He says, that's just the whole trouble, Goethe isn't dead yet. This is typical of his spirit. And that's the kind of a bounce this group has got. It's a puzzlement, I'll admit, to all of us who've known a church college and its educational discipline. Why our church colleges have not been able to give this sort of a sass to its graduates. Why they have become sort of timid and cheerful men, and their imagination's not been explored. So this kind of literature should be pouring from our campuses and from our faculties. And it hasn't. Beloit, of course, is an independent college, a very excellent one. It has been vastly penetrated by this D.S. Lewis spirit because of a fellow there who has been one of its spirit. What's his name?
Chad Wall.
Chad Wall. He's my scholar.
I'm just his memory.
He's my resource, but he is. And his influence,
card file.
Their influence has been felt elsewhere, in Elton Trueblood, for example, and so on. But it's been amazing how derivatory and sort of echo-like the scholarship and the attitudes of some Church College graduates have been. Timid. And not this kind of grand sort of this carefree spirit in which the imagination rolls and they're free. I wrote a little article on it, didn't get printed after Dr. Zhivago came up here. But it was strange that a novel like this should come out of Russia, which we would rather expect might have come out of one of the church college graduates in America with this gift, but nothing like it has. Here, out of a communist Russia comes a significant Christian novel. And it's sort of amazing, isn't it? We don't produce this kind of literature out of ours, but these men have. And of course, from the core and heart of the English-speaking world, it's Oxford College and that particular complex. Now, as I understand, the faculty at Oxford got more and more restive with Lewis and made life a little tougher for him all the time, so he finally moved over to Cambridge, and that's where he ended his days. But this group has its original impetus in that particular atmosphere. Biography of C.S. Lewis, I still remember very vividly, they gave him a picture on the front page. This was about 47, 48. I think the book club took for its book once Screwtape Letters during the war. And this is one of the first books I read on my return and wrote him a letter at once because obviously here was a first-rate mind having a good time and he let you have a good time. But Time had under the picture of C.S. Lewis the little caption, "His heresy is orthodoxy." And that's a good way to put it, because in our time at this moment, to be orthodox is to be more exciting than any heresy. And it's, of course, to be a minority, but to be an exciting one. I'm going to read a little of Charles Williams after a bit, but I'd like to have you comment a little bit here, any of the rest of you, after this little introduction. Mary, do you have something that you'd like to say?
Well, I have a great deal to say. But I don't know whether I've got time to say it.
Well, say as much as you'd like.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much you want to read. I mean, are you going to read?
Whatever you like. No, no. I'll just read enough to take us into the supper hour after you're through.
Well,
I'm going to take just one little essay here of his on the cross. It's just a layman saying what the cross means to him, but it's a very profound statement. Go ahead.
Well, the only thing I don't want to. If you want to read that essay,
no, I'll just read part of
that.
No, I'd rather hear it from you. Come on, stop arguing.
Well,
if you've been reading C.S. Lewis lately, you know that women are to be subject to men because and this is their fulfillment and the excitement. And this is, this is very clear in C.S. Lewis.
It's also very clear in Carol Hinderly.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I won't argue anymore. I'll just get to the heart of the matter. The fact that Charles Williams is the sort of I think he is the most dynamic figure in this group is not because he's the most solitary of the men in the group, but because he had enough problems in his own mental and spiritual life, so that he lived through a great deal of the fears and joys that he describes in his novels. And I think this is also why he's able to write the kind of thing that you find in this essay that Carol's referring to called The Happy Exchange. The novels of all these people are not like John Updike's Couples. The emphasis on sex is is what you might call distilled, because it sees the whole relationship of male and female as part of the great incarnation, and a part of the understanding of the incarnation as an affirmation of sex as a positive force and not as a divisive force in life, which you find in all of our modern novels today. And this is what, it's true, as Carol says, the ladies in there are not very flesh and bloody, but they play a certain part in the development. And I don't think the men are so terribly, you know, they haven't got so much feel to them either. I think most of the novels are the authors are trying to put in story form the doctrines and the thoughts that they've had in exchange with each other, and put them in such a form that we can remember them and enter into them in terms of plot. The plots are exciting. The people are more mouthpieces for certain ideas that these men had. And in this respect, the style in which these books are written, I would say, is one of the primary qualities of all of these novels. It's a quality that is common to all of them. Not one of these books that you read is written in a cheap, tawdry, sentimental, trashy style. Every one of these men knows what the English language is about. And that's something that not very many people know in today's world, I personally think. But then I'm prejudiced because I majored in English. But in spite of the fact that they are remarkably concerned about style, the style does not become heavy or laborious. It carries the ideas the way proper language should. And this is why, when Carol started his discussion last night with the staff, he started it out with the idea of the fact that revival of language usually precedes the revival of a religious awakening.
I quoted Luther, because Luther says this, and
that's
it's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
He says, every awakening of the church has been preceded by a revival of language, sensitivity to it, understanding of it. I mean, CP's Vesper talks would be impossible apart from his sensitivity to language and its nuances, which you capture every now and then, and from a knowledge of several. You don't know your own until you know another. And this is very, very real in these very simple kind of addresses, in a sense, and yet very subtle and effective. This feel for language is part of the word breaking through. Go ahead, I'm sorry. Just ad-libbing to Western voice.
Fine with me if you ad lib, just so you don't take over. This power of language, as far as these writers are concerned, is almost mystical. Now, I felt it last night when Pastor Rasmussen used the word to know. Didn't you use cognosco?
Yeah, he used cognosco.
Cognosco, and he said, you know, you feel the tremblingness of that word, the vitality of that word to know from the Greek, that you don't know, and also from the Latin,
that you don't necessarily get from the word in English, no, because it's kind of a flat sound to it. But the word in another, in the Greek and in the Latin, both have a sort of a rumble to them that makes your flesh tingle. These men felt this in the power of language. They felt that language was almost mystical in its power. And this is why in The Hideous Strength, you get the feeling of these men who can control language as being the people who can control the whole society. And all of you who have read George Orwell, 1984, remember his famous section on no speak, you know, how they twist the words around so that freedom and liberty and truth, you mean, sure, you can use them all you want, or they don't mean anything anymore. They've been drained of their meaning. And this is also true in Huxley's Brave New World, and I guess you have to revisit Brave New World because this generation hasn't read it. I think a lot of the people here are in our generation, so you probably know about it, but we've noticed that a lot of the kids on the staff never heard of Brave New World, but they haven't heard of Brave New World Revisited, which all is, you know, it's sort of a shock to realize that there's a generation gap, even when you don't think so, on the volleyball court or in the sauna. The feeling of language that you get for instance, from the biblical point of view, when man was given the power to name, this in itself has a power to it. And this is the Charles Williams feels, and this permeates this circle, so that there's a kind of a control when you know the name of something. Now, this is not only true in our own biblical background, but it's certainly true in a lot of the primitive religions. You know, some of these, even these voodoo religions, if you know the name of something, you've got the power to hurt it, because if you know a name, you can use that name and it becomes a way in which you can control that person. Now, this is spiritualism, and yet it has validity in certain areas of the world. And then the fact that language not only has this tremendous mystical power and sense of control over people and societies, but it's the way in which we have exchange with one another. And this is not only the happy exchange between Christ and us, but the way in which the happy exchange between you and me takes place. So that as Christ bears our burdens, we can bear each other's burdens. And it's through language that we are able to communicate this. Now, Marshall McLuhan I don't disagree with him, but I mean, I have to put him aside because I don't think everything he says is right by any means. And I still think language is a very strong and powerful means of communication. And if we're going to drop language down the drain, I wonder, you know, how long it will remain similar. That's not Martin McLuhan's point of view. He thinks we're going to get along fine without language and just use certain other forms of communication that are going to be symbolic rather than in terms of words.
In fairness to him, though, he hates it himself.
Well, his style is so terrible that I can see why he hates language.
No. He says he hates that kind of world.
I know he does, but I sort of felt that part of this was the fact that he's kind of sloppy in his English. But the fact that language is the way you and I communicate with each other, and how we express our love and concern for each other as exchangeable Christians. And this is true in these novels of Charles Williams in a very exciting way. One novel that Carol referred to a while ago in one of our discussions is the Descent into Hell, and it's about a girl named Pauline who has a real problem of the doppelganger, the idea of another self, and she sees
herself coming at her every once in a while.
She continually has this actual person coming towards her who is herself, and she has this fear that she's going to actually meet that person. And when she meets that person who is her other self, she knows she'll either go mad or die. And this fright, this terror, grips her so that she can't live with it. And she has this wonderful friend who is a poet named Stanhope, Peter Stanhope. And he says to her, look, he says this in language, not by a rub down, not by a volleyball game, but he says it in communication by word of mouth. He says to her, look, as Christ says, bear ye one another's burdens. Now, I'm going to take that doppelganger, I'm going to take that person that is frightening you, and I'm going to take that into myself. And I'm going to bear that for you, because Christ has borne my burdens, and he says I should bear your burdens. And that's something I can do for you as a Christian. Pauline says, she can't believe this is possible.
She's not a Christian herself.
No, she can't. She doesn't see that this
is a typical modern.
In any, she's not in any, she can't believe it. And this is what's so great, is that she doesn't have any belief in this. But he does, and he takes it. And the description of the way in which he contemplates and thinks about this doppelganger, this other person that's meeting Pauline and is driving her solely mad out of terror, is a tremendous portion in the writings of Charles Williams. Now, you might say, this is really getting out of hand. But I really wonder, why in the world Jesus Christ had to bother to die on the cross if all he's dying for are a lot of little moral do's and don'ts that we sort of, we do or we don't, but I mean, it's a matter of kind of indifference to us. If there aren't demonic powers that Christ was conquering, then it seems to me that the cross was a pretty extreme method for God to go to in order to conquer it. There's more inside of us than we want to admit. I've discovered that myself. I thought I was a real good kid, a very nice person, until I got sick. And I found out a lot of things about myself that nobody else knows, I hope. But I would like to the reason I want to emphasize this is that the novels of Charles Williams are all involved in these inside kinds of powers, these terrific drives and energies that are actually tearing at our soul in order to gain control of them. And the more we relate to this kind of knife society, of which the Hideous Strength talks about, the more we can forget this kind of battle, and the less we understand Paul or the New Testament in terms of a battle. And even a person like Lawrence Vanderpost, who is one of my favorites from the writings, he's a British citizen, but he writes from South Africa, from his life in South Africa, writes about this, and I'd like to use him as just one sentence commentary on these writers, because he shows so clearly what they are trying to get at, and he shows it from a person outside this circle, outside this idea completely. He says, the battle for Africa, for the peace and the sanity of men, which in its ancient sense meant wholeness of mind and body, the spirit made immediate in being, is so urgent that it has to be fought on all levels of life, national, international, economic, ideologic, political, artistic, and spiritual. But it can be fought successfully only if the individual carries with him an awareness within himself of the forces and values discussed here. And this is where what Al said the other day, and I belligerently disagreed with on, that a war can be started with two people, is true. I mean, this is absolutely true that war, as Carol used to say in Germany, is myself writ large, I mean, I'm just, it's just my name instead of Hitler's name. This was during the war of Second World War. We were in Norway, and Hitler had moved into Norway while we were there. And this is true, that you realize that inside yourself, these forces are actually taking place. And this is what these novelists do. They dramatize this.
So my own aggressiveness written large and organized.
That's right.
This is what I say. And this is what war is.
I couldn't remember that quotation. I had it written down a long time ago, but I lost that diary. But that's true. You know, it's yourself written large and organized. And when you realize that these forces in yourself of you know, grasp for power, selfishness, covetousness, envy, jealousy, adultery, hatred, all these things are inside of you and me, then you can begin to understand why the battle was so tremendous that Christ had to fight for us and that he won. And this is why the novels of these men are exciting, but they're not exciting if you think life is made up of, you know, fried eggs for breakfast
and
vitamin pills. I mean, if that's life, then okay, you might as well forget these people because they're involved in something that's far more dynamic than three meals a day. Although Charles Williams has a very good little statement on how important a cup of tea is.
They all do have that.
You can't avoid this. You've got to have some of these creature comforts. But that this is not the only thing that life is made up of.
Well, and I see very vividly is, for instance, one of the first remarks on his discussion of the cross, is that you can dramatize this evil, make it big, and make it seem like it belongs to such a or destructive time as our own. But he says even more peaceful times, man still has the very burden of daily existence, which too often seems a curse. This monotony, this boredom, this taking for granted that destroys the meaning of life. In the just normal, ordinary life of everyone, the whole creation groaneth and travaileth together. This fight against apathy and just man living as though he could be a spectator to his own existence. Instead that he is also its final victim, and that death is the final wages he pays for this kind of sin. This just always evades and escapes him. As Freud says, no one ever dreams his own death. I don't know if that's true or not, but Freud makes this remark, that you never really visualize it. It happens to someone else, it won't happen to me, really. This is the way we protect ourselves. And this kind of humdrum existence, as though no conflict between God and Satan involves me.
Carol, there's one thing that William said that I ignored. I was going to tell you about, and I forgot that the imagination. This is why, you know, the name of this particular seminar is called the Restoration of the Christian Imagination. There are two kinds of imagination. You can have an imagination that is just demonic and is simply to your own detriment, and then you can have an imagination that is under Christ that becomes a Christian kind of imagination, which extends your world and makes you able to identify with the world about you and become, as in this case of this happy exchange of this doppelganger in that one novel, so that you can actually become for another person a Christ for that person and a real burden bearer. And there was one other thing that I wanted to mention before went into that essay. The little book, the novel that I just finished reading now, The Shadows of Ecstasy, is on the idea of imagination, which is used to the demonic and not for the Christian development of the race. And it's the story of a very, very exciting story, actually, of an African uprising led by a man who has lived for 200 years. He's lived because of the fact that he's made use of every power known to man's own nature, his sex, his power drives,
his desire for interest and his sorrows, everything is sublimated so that it is transposed into actual physical power. And by means of this tremendous and very strange kind of thing, this particular man, who became the leader of this uprising, a British citizen, actually was able to live on this power by sublimating all these, particularly the drive for love. He was able to live all these years on this kind of strange continuation of power that was simply that he had sort of pulled into himself by the power of his imagination. And the difference between this kind of demonic imagination, which was actually working for the complete downfall of everything that was in the Christian concept of life, is the crux of the plot of this novel. It's so Nietzschean. It's so much like Wagner. I mean, you may love Wagner, it's perfectly right with me. But you know, the Wagnerian hero, the feeling of being able to kind of control everything, because you go down in death with great power, and then this power is actually transmuted into the next generation because you've got that much sort of strength in you. And it's a Superman idea, and this is what goes on here. The difference between that and the understanding that the real power comes with the person who is willing to suffer defeat. And this is made very clear, and that this is what Christianity is, because Christ was the one who, instead of coming out in a Nietzschean approach, went to the cross and taught us the lesson of life. A great novel, really exciting. I had to sit up till 1 o'clock the other morning, and I tiptoed out of bed so Carol wouldn't hear me think I was getting an asthma attack.
Well, these are the fun things about them, in that they always are involved in the concrete and the particular. That's why they can write. They refuse to let this be abstracted. And though when we have a discussion, we naturally abstract from it, we should return again to the particular and the color and the scent and the smell. Of this sensate world that they're writing about, because it is vivid and exciting, and that's why they are still being sold. Every bookstore still got these things around. It doesn't belong to the antiquarian world by any means. And in fact, last year, the annual edition of the Science Fiction Gang had a final taped interview with C.S. Lewis and Hammond Innes and another of these science fiction men from England, just writing about the fact that these were still the classics in the science fiction world. And apart from their theology, apart from anything else, they capture you, and that's why I could make it required for my conference, and they didn't mind it as a requirement at all. I used to make my conference all read out of The Silent Planet. Just to stretch their minds a little, because they're living in a cosmic age to realize that it was possible to exegete the 15th chapter of Luke as does. Only what kind of exegesis that really holds water for it, I guess, doesn't it? More than the other 99 that need no repentance. You don't find them on earth, so they must be out there somewhere. And this is what Out of the Silent Planet reveals, doesn't it? We're a silent planet because we're the planet that's been quarantined. We're under the bent Aleville, the fallen angel. I'll read a little bit about the cross here in conclusion before supper. He's discussing this whole matter of evil and its relationship to our world, this ongoing world of pain and evil. And he says, at least on the Christian showing, he consented to be himself subject to it. If obscurely, he would not cease to preserve us in the full horror of existence. At least he shared it. He became as helpless as we under the will which is he. This is the first approach to a sense of justice in the whole situation. He became as helpless as we. This is a biblically informed kind of theology that's the basis of all these writings, and this is the excitement. God uses the ordinary, the everyday, for his redemptive purpose. And in certain kinds of situations, he can seem simply as helpless as we. The Almighty God of Scripture is not the omnipotent God of the philosopher. He depends on you and me. The all-knowing God of Scripture is not the omniscient God of the philosophers. He doesn't even know what's going on inside of you, as you ask him. He doesn't, he has no peeping Tom. He doesn't intrude. He doesn't say, search me, O God, know my heart. This is the biblical God. Unfortunately, it's difficult for us to get it because most of us have the God of Kant, Immanuel Kant, of the philosophers. But this is the biblical God which is related to the books and it makes us excited. The issue isn't determined. John the Baptist did get his head cut off, which used to make me mad as hops when I was a boy. Does God's job for him? And then God let the one snip of a girl cut off his head. I didn't like girls for a long time because of it. And God gets undone by a little dancing girl? Even Herod had enough sense he didn't want to put him to death, you know. But this is the God of Scripture. At least he shared. He became as helpless as we under the will which is he. This is the first approach to a sense of justice in the whole situation. It's the only reason why I could grow to love him. Myself. Whatever he chose fully, for himself as for us. For himself as for us. You realize that there's an element of orthodoxy which is completely heretical, which is in the Roman Catholic tradition, which we in the Lutheran have tried to overthrow. It was called heresy as a patria patrum, that God suffers as the Father. Of course he suffers, as only a Father can in the Son. This comes from Aristotle, who had an aseptic idea of God. God doesn't suffer. He's the unmoved mover. That's the God of the philosophers, not the God of Scripture. For himself as for us. This is, I think, unique in the theistic religions of the world. I do not remember any other in which the Creator so accepted his own term, at least in the limited sense of existence upon this earth. It is true his life was short, his pains, humanly speaking, comparatively brief, but at least alone among the gods he deigned to endure the justice he decreed. Now I'm going to read one other paragraph to go to dinner with it. They can't eat without us because we're too many. He was not like us, yet he became us. This is the keynote of this whole theology. He was not like us, yet he became us. What happened there, the church itself has never seen. He just said just before this, it is in the Gospels that the really terrifying attacks on the Gospel lie. This is true. Any of us who read the Bible knows its own critic. He was not like us, and yet he became us. What happened there, the church itself has never seen. Except that in the last reaches of that living death to which we are exposed, he substituted himself for us. He submitted in our stead to the full results of the law, which is he. This is the theology of the pain of God, and God against himself, as Luther writes. We may believe he was generous if we know that he was just. It's a marvelous sentence. We may believe he was generous if we know he was just. There's not a sentimentality about the cross that so oftentimes fills our thinking and focus. But this anguish of, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? By that central substitution, which was the thing added by the cross to the incarnation, he became everywhere the center of, and everywhere he energized and reformed all our substitutions and exchanges. You see, this concept is what informs all this literature. We may believe he was generous if we know that he was just. By that central substitution, which was the thing added by the cross to the incarnation, he became everywhere the center of, and everywhere he energized and reaffirmed all our substitutions and exchanges. He took what remained after the fall of the torn web of humanity in all times and places, and not so much by a miracle of healing as by a growth within it, made it whole. This is what our Lutheran church believes when it says that Christ actually gives us his body to eat and his blood to drink and his bread and his wine. By growth within it, he makes it whole. Supernaturally, he renewed our proper nature. By so doing, it is true, he redoubled, at least within the church, our guilt and our distress. Now the impossible possibility is there. And if we're not sons of God, we have this added grief, that my grief is in the dullness with which this sluggish heart is open to the fullness of all thou wouldst impart. He redoubled, at least within the church, our guilt and our distress. That's why really only in the church is there conviction of sin. The world feels guilt, but not guilty. And that we are guilty, and that's why we need this forgiveness. When he had made hope a virtue, he prevented it from being a natural habit. Another wonderful line. When he made hope a virtue, he prevented it from being a natural habit. Oh, I'm an optimistic guy. I know he's going to work out. That's as unlike what Christianity is as anything can be. That is divine. In all failures of love, there is left to us only a trust in his work. That is what we call faith, a kind of quality of action. It is, however, a trust in what is already done. Not only his act, but all our acts are finished. So thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven means precisely that at any moment the holy desire is already accomplished. Not perhaps in the sense that we desire, but in the sense that he wills it. It is finished. We too do but play out the necessary ceremony. Then he speaks about the bombs and so on. And in a wonderful way relates us to the old Israel, the Jew, in which it says, they have carried us in the promise, and we carry them in the fulfillment. It's a magnificent insight that has informed this century and that is refreshing all. We'll see you again tonight.